This week's addendum is brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office takes way too much time, and a postage meter is really expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial plus $110 in a bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED. Undisclosed is also brought to you by 23andMe. Your DNA is made up of 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's why the name of the product is 23andMe. 23andMe is a personalized genetic service that helps you understand what your DNA says about you. 23andMe is the first and only genetic service available directly to you that includes reports that meet FDA standards. With 23andMe, you get more than 60 personalized, detailed reports on your health, traits, and ancestry, plus tools that allow you to share and compare your genetic reports with family and friends. Here's how it works. Order your DNA kit from 23andMe.com. Provide your saliva sample from home and mail it back to the CLIA-certified lab. You'll be notified when your reports are ready online. More than 1 million people around the world have experienced their genetics through 23andMe. Order your kit today from 23andMe.com. Hi, and welcome to the 13th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm a lawyer and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor at the Evidence Prof blog. In last week's episode, we talked about Bilal and his disappearing act right before Adnan's trial. In response to that episode, one of the most common questions I keep getting is this. Since you are in contact with Bilal, why don't you just ask him why he left? Here's the thing, though. I did ask him. But his response was a combination of, you don't understand what was happening then, and I left because of family reasons. Now, as someone who has been through a bad divorce, I can totally see why anybody would want to split from the area. And I can also see why someone would want to split the area if your entire community became aware of you being charged with a sexual offense against a minor. They are both legitimate reasons for taking off. And I would buy that there was no connection between Bilal's arrest and that no charges were filed and him avoiding to have to testify for Adnan if it wasn't for this. The only reason I even delved into any of this was because of sources telling me that there was a connection. And I don't believe Bilal's response. The timing was way too coincidental. On top of which, I've spoken to lots of people in the community, and we have virtually confirmed that this alleged victim's age was around 14 or 15 years old. Some say he looked so young, he looked like he could have been in middle school. And these are people who knew him personally. One of the community members that I spoke to is a young man named Rashad who happens to know Adnan since he was a child, but also knows Bilal since he was 7 or 8, and in fact even knows the alleged victim of this crime. And this is what Rashad remembers of the time that Bilal was arrested.
Rashad, do you remember in October of 1999 when Bilal was arrested for sexual misconduct with a minor?
Yes.
Okay, can you tell me what you remember about that and what you know about the kid? Just anything you want.
I actually remember the kid coming. He was saying he just moved from Kosovo. They had just moved from Kosovo. And it was like the weirdest thing. Like the day before it happened, I was just at the Ambassador of Columbia. And they had like some functions, some family functions. It wasn't a family function for them. It was a function for the rest of the community. Correct, I guess you could say.
At the mosque, okay.
Yeah, at the mosque. So I see the kid, he's there with his sisters. I kind of knew his older brother because his older brother worked for my father trying to get into computers and things like that when my father worked in the state. Well, I remember him, and he was just a little different because he didn't play with any boys. He was dressed up in slacks and like a button-down shirt, and he was always playing with his sisters. But I remember his older brother, and they were there. So when it happened, I was like, okay, this is really weird. I just saw that kid, and I had no idea Bilal even knew him.
Bilal was tutoring him. His wife, his ex-wife now, told me that the kid would come to their house and Bilal was tutoring him, but obviously it was more than that. But here's my question for you. First of all, do you know how old that kid was? Like, because
he was like 14, 15 years old. Because he was a little younger than me.
Okay.
Probably like a year, just at my age. But like I said, he was just a little different. He didn't want to play any sports. He didn't really want to talk to any other males. He was just hanging around his sisters all the time.
Okay. But you're positive. You are positive that he was younger than you.
Yeah. Or like I said, like about the same age, the younger, maybe just a little bit younger than me.
Okay.
Just about my age, just a little bit younger than me. Because I remember I didn't really talk to him. He wasn't outgoing at all. Like his brother, who was older than me, he was a nice guy. He was like 18 years old, but he was totally different than his little brother.
So the brother was 18. So you know that his younger brother was obviously a minor. His little brother, who was the alleged victim here, was absolutely not over 18.
100% he wasn't over. He didn't even look like he was 20. It was like the weird thing. He looked like a kid. He looked like literally like he was in middle school. He looked like he was actually younger than me.
Something else interesting that I learned was this, that as the community became aware of Bilal's arrest, they had no idea that he had actually been released. Because he completely disappeared from the community, people thought he was still in prison the entire time. And so Rashad describes a time a couple of weeks after the arrest when he happened to be in another part of town, Ellicott City, further away from the city, and saw Bilal walking down the road and was completely gobsmacked because he did not know that he was still out and about.
You know, I'm sitting there thinking, because I was sitting there and I was like, this is really weird that he's not, this is not like this happened in the early 90s, where, you know, people were, where this really wasn't that big of a thing, or it was a big thing, but it wasn't being taken seriously as it was. So I was thinking, this is like 1999, 2000, like, dude, why did he not go to jail?
Yeah.
Like, really, they knew the kid was under 8. And the way the police found him, like, come on, now that's crazy. Like, how did he not go to jail? And I was, like, sitting there, like, that's unbelievable. Everybody thought, oh, he's definitely going away. He's definitely going away. But that's what I said. It was so weird that I saw him on the road because I didn't think that he would ever see the light of day ever again.
Wow.
You know, especially given the kid's age. He was 14, 15 years old. And I was like, dog, that's crazy. That's crazy.
And this is the same thing I heard over and over again by different members of the community who knew about the incident and who knew the child. This is another community member who was part of the board of the mosque in 1999.
You were active in the community in 1999 when this incident took place, correct?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Did you know that young boy who was the alleged victim in this assault case?
I've met him several times, but saying I knew him, I knew of him.
But you had met him. You had seen him.
I've met him several times. Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I mean, I had personal contact with him. I know he was 14. He was in the age group of 14. He was not anywhere near 18 years old.
So in what world do the police not press charges against a grown man caught molesting a child? A child whose age is easily verifiable through the community, a child who is a refugee, and as a refugee will have all kinds of documentation about his age. As far as I am concerned, that would happen if the police needed something from that man, and he delivered. So why won't Bilal, if indeed there was a connection between charges not being filed and this incident being literally brushed under the rug and him not testifying for Adnan, why won't he admit that there's a connection in there? Well, think about it like this. For Bilal to tell the truth would mean admitting that the police used a false pretense to avoid bringing charges because, remember, they told his ex-wife that they couldn't verify the victim's age. And Bilal has little incentive to admit it, because if he did, he would be admitting that, in fact, he did abuse a minor child. Another question related to Bilal, or rather Adnan's alibi for the evening of January 13th, is this. If there are thousands of people who are coming to the mosque in Ramadan, how come Bilal was the only one who could potentially be his alibi? What about other people at the mosque? And there are a couple of reasons that probably didn't work out for Adnan. One being that, from what I know, Christina Gutierrez didn't really reach out to other members of the mosque. But the other one is this. Imagine, if you will, 29 or 30 days of gathering every evening at a mosque with hundreds, if not thousands, of people there. And then being asked months later to remember a specific night and if a particular person was there. For most people, it would be nearly impossible for them to pinpoint whether or not Adnan was there on the 13th unless they had a specific reason to remember it. And Bilal had a specific reason to remember it because he reviewed Adnan's notes for his presentation the next day. So from what I know, Bilal was really one of the only people who had a very specific memory of that night. And it was a memory that actually could be corroborated because other people do remember, in fact, that Adnan was slated to present and did present on the 14th. But as for other community members, if they had been asked months later, I imagine it would have been nearly impossible for them to remember that night for sure.
So here's Colin with answers to a few Twitter questions. After that, we'll go back to a topic we discussed in a prior episode, one that may be the biggest issue in this case.
This question comes from Nikita Izzard. Her Twitter handle is @NikitaIzzard. She asks, was Jen's grand jury testimony something that should have been disclosed to defense? The answer to Nikita's question is yes, assuming a request was made by Gutierrez. Now, on this podcast, I previously mentioned the Federal Jencks Act. That's the act that says that any prior statement by a witness for the prosecution has to be turned over to the defense upon request at the latest after that witness has testified on direct examination. Now, what I will say is every state has their own version of the Jencks Act. In some states, even with a defense request, prosecution only turns over the statement to the judge who decides whether that statement is relevant and has to be turned over. In other jurisdictions, there has to be a special showing of relevance made by the defense before such a statement is turned over. What about Maryland? Well, in Maryland, neither of those restrictions apply. So I'm quoting here from the opinion of the Court of Appeals of Maryland in Jones versus State. We hold that the procedure suggested by the state and followed in some jurisdictions, of having the trial judge inspect the grand jury testimony to determine whether inconsistencies exist or whether that testimony would be of use to the defendant, as was done in this case, is improper. Looking further in the opinion, indeed, the state acknowledges that Jencks normally contemplates the opportunity of defense counsel to view the prior statement and that it has been deemed important to permit counsel's eyes to examine the statement for inconsistencies and that there is generally no requirement for showing a particularized need for the document beyond the desire to test credibility and impeach the witness. So there it is. Very simply, in Maryland, assuming defense counsel makes a request and says a witness is testifying at trial, they previously testified before the grand jury, I want to test their credibility, I might want to impeach them. In that case, per se, prosecution should turn over that grand jury testimony. And yet, as far as we can tell in the defense files, there's no grand jury transcript for Jen, for the detectives, for any witness other than those represented by Gutierrez. Question becomes, is this another case of Gutierrez dropping the ball? She certainly didn't cross-examine witnesses at trial based upon their grand jury testimony. It's tough to say, but it looks to me again like Gutierrez wasn't doing her due diligence and it really prevented a key opportunity to impeach and impugn the credibility of witnesses, assuming they made inconsistent statements before the grand jury. This question comes from James B. Satterwhite. His Twitter handle is @JBTrey. He asks, to clarify, Jay was threatened with either death penalty trial or testify slash guilty after the fact, max 2 years. James is referring to what Ann Benaroya told me, which is that Jay had only two options in this case. Either one, he played ball with Urich, he accepted a plea deal in which he testified against Adnan and pleaded guilty to accessory after the fact in exchange for a recommendation of 2 years incarceration and ultimately no actual term of incarceration. Or two, Jay doesn't play ball. Urich kicks the case from Baltimore City to Baltimore County. Jay is charged with murder one, and unlike the prosecutors in Baltimore City, the prosecutors in Baltimore County in all likelihood pursue the death penalty. Now, I wanted to follow up to see the actual numbers to back up what Benaroya told me, and it turns out that she is backed up. In 2000, right after Adnan's trial, Maryland Governor Paris Glendening decides, I'm going to commission a study into the imposition of the death penalty in Maryland. That study was an empirical analysis of Maryland's death sentencing system with respect to the influence of race and legal jurisdiction. The study looked into the imposition of the death penalty from 1978 to 1999 in Maryland. And what it found was the following. In Baltimore City, when a case was death eligible, the prosecution only pursued the death penalty in 6% of those death-eligible cases. By way of contrast, in Baltimore County, when a case was death-eligible, the prosecution sought the death penalty in 65% of those cases. Now, you might wonder, are there variables at play that might have affected the judgment of the prosecutors in those cases? Well, actually, those variables make that disparity even wider. According to this study, the probability that a notification to seek death will be filed in Baltimore County is over 13 times higher than in Baltimore City, even after taking into account important case characteristics. Now, understandably, as a result of this study, Governor Glendening says, we can't have the death penalty in Maryland based upon these differences in jurisdiction. He declares a moratorium, no death penalty in Maryland. His successor decides, I'm going to lift the moratorium. So Maryland had the death penalty for a few years after that. But then in 2013, ultimately, Maryland passes a law. It repeals the death penalty in Maryland. It's signed in by then Governor O'Malley. And so as of 2013, any defendant in state court in Maryland cannot be given the death penalty.
Now, I've mentioned numerous times before, both in previous episodes and on social media, if you follow me on Twitter, that we've been having some trouble getting documents that we requested through MPIA request to different state entities, and most specifically, Baltimore County Police Department. Recently, though, Susan received a few odd documents that we've never seen before, and one of these documents may answer one of the biggest mysteries of the entire case. How did Jay know where Hayes' car was?
If you'll recall, the Crime Stoppers tip came in on February 1st. This was when it was still a missing persons case and when Baltimore County was still handling it. The Baltimore County Police Department would have been the first agency to learn the Crime Stoppers tip and the first to follow up on it. So a few weeks back, I sent an MPIA request to the Baltimore County Police Department asking for any documents related to the Crime Stoppers tip, as well as any documents related to a few other topics that have come up in the course of our investigation. 30 days later, which is the deadline for an MPIA response, nothing. That came and went without a response from the Baltimore County Police Department. So I waited a few weeks and then I sent an email just to check in saying, hey, before I take further action here, I don't suppose that you guys sent something and got lost in the mail. And then suddenly the very next morning, they sent an email to me with a response, CC to Vicky Wash. Unfortunately, the response they sent contained nothing more than the same generic pages that they've previously sent to other MPIA requests. As far as I know, there's nothing here they haven't given to, say, Serial or to other people. There was nothing in there about Crime Stoppers or about any of the other specific topics that I'd asked for in my original request. So, what did we get? Well, first of all, we got the same police reports from the missing persons case that were part of the Baltimore Police Department's file, and some of which were introduced at trial. This includes, for instance, Officer Adcock's report, as well as the reports of officers who talked to Hayes' family in the days after her disappearance. In addition to those documents, though, we also got 3 or 4 new police reports that were never produced to Gutierrez, and before now, I personally hadn't seen. Even in the same police reports that we'd previously gotten, though, there was at least one thing new there. On the very first page of Officer Adcock's narrative, there's something missing in the report. Now, in the copy we have, the copy that came from the Baltimore Police Department, and the copy that presumably Detectives Ritz and McGillivray were working off of, there's a notation at the bottom of the first paragraph, which provides that Hay was last seen after leaving for school, and that Mr. Lee, Hay's brother, advised that victim Lee drives his mother's car, a 1998 Nissan Sentra, gray in color, with Maryland tags of blank. Picks up child at 1500-1515 hours. Now, that last sentence is written in different handwriting, so I wasn't sure what it meant at the time. I figured maybe another officer involved in the early stages of the investigation had added it in. But it seems to say that, well, it seems to say that she did pick up the child at 3 o'clock or 3:15. I'm guessing what it means is that she was supposed to pick up her cousin at approximately 3 o'clock, 3:15. Which, you know, is another thing the police never actually nailed down. They never talked to the school. They never asked the family point blank in the investigation, as far as we know, what time Hay was supposed to be there at Campfield Daycare. We do know from the detective's interview with Debbie that they believed it was about 3:20 p.m., but again, no source for that. Well, if you check the original documents, the original police reports filed by Officer Adcock with the Baltimore County Police Department, that last sentence isn't there. There is no line about picks up child at 3 to 3:15 p.m. So whoever wrote that, it wasn't Baltimore County. That's a later addition, which means at no point did Baltimore County ever figure out when Hay was supposed to show up at the school to pick up her cousin. Now, the new documents. There are 3 of them. The first one you've heard of before. In Serial, in one of the early episodes, it was mentioned how on February 6th, the Baltimore County Police did a search using a dog. Hay's curling iron was used as a scent article for the dog to try and track. The search came up empty. They didn't find anything. But the report itself is interesting. The search was done on the morning of Saturday, February 6th. Officer Garner and his dog, whose name is Clue, in case you were wondering, I was, went out to the high school to conduct a search and searched the grounds and immediate surrounding area of Woodlawn Senior High School for missing person Hay Lee. Officer Garner wrote, "Since most of the grounds consisted of open fields, our search concentrated heavily on the wooded areas that fringe the property. These woods, approximately 25 to 50 yards wide, consisting of heavy underbrush, were searched thoroughly. A stream runs through the wooded area. Both banks were also detailed as much as possible. Some portions of the stream were inaccessible due to the depth of the water." Now, there's 2 interesting points here. The first is the fact that a search was conducted with a dog at all. At this point, it's been a while since Hay disappeared, so it's not unreasonable that the police would start to wonder if they actually had a murder case in their hands. But it could also suggest that the cops had gotten that February 1st tip from Crime Stoppers, and it was in response to that they started to believe they might have a homicide on their hands, which is why they decided to search the woodlands around Woodlawn High School. But second, what I find interesting is the focus they gave to the stream. That would have been Dead Run, actually. The same stream that runs through Lincoln Park. But the section they searched was actually basically next to the high school. So you have lots and lots of fields. They didn't search there because it's obvious if something's there or not. And instead, they had the dog search in these narrow strips of brush and undergrowth that surrounded the stream. But the fact they're paying so much attention to the water and say some portions of the stream were inaccessible due to the depth of the water indicates that they were actually looking in the water itself. Again, this goes back to my theory about the Crime Stoppers tip. If, like the notes from BPD say, the tip hadn't been about looking for a car in the water, which is what Massey's memo says, but had instead been about searching for a body in the water, well, that could tell us why Officer Garner and Clue were looking in the streams around Woodlawn High School.
So what do you make of that, Susan? Why do you think they were so heavily focused on the water?
I wonder if this goes back to my theory about the Crime Stoppers tip. We have the Massey memo, which says that when the tipster called on the 12th, the tipster talked about how Anon would have ditched his girlfriend's car in the water somewhere to get rid of it. But we have these other notes from the police file. They're not dated. There's no names in them. We're not even really sure who the interview was of. And it says, and it refers to the anonymous call too, the tipster call. But it says that the tipster call talked about the non hiding a body in the water, not a car. Now, if the tip about hiding a body in the water was in fact the February 1st tip, that could be why Officer Garner and Clue are searching the stream for hay. Because they've been told there may be a body hidden in water somewhere, so they go to the nearest body of water around Woodlawn High School where she was last seen. On the other hand, I do wonder if this could also be in response to the previous death of a Woodlawn girl the year before, Jada Lambert. She too disappeared under mysterious circumstances with no sign, and her body was later found in a park, not Lincoln Park, a park on the other side of town, dumped in a stream. We know from the Baltimore County's maps that they were also considering a connection between Jada Lambert and Hay, so it's possible that's why the stream was chosen, because they knew they had a killer whose MO involved dumping bodies in streams, and they wanted to see if that had been repeated here. The last two pages in the report were done much later. The very last one was a simple report dated February 9th and stamped February 12th that says, on February 9th, 1999, the body of Hay Lee was discovered in the Lincoln Park area of Baltimore City. The incident is being investigated as a homicide. As of this report, the 1998 Nissan is still missing. But the final page from the file, well, it's interesting. It's also bizarre. And to explain why, we need to back up a bit and talk about the Baltimore County Police investigation forms and what they show. At the bottom of each Form 11 supplement, in which the police can write a narrative of what they did and what they found and what they investigated, there's a section that says screening factors and has for revised total and total factors and lists columns A, B, C, D, E, F. In every previous report, those factors were either listed as zero or not listed at all. Then we get to this last page of the investigation. Now, again, I have a lot of questions about this report because, for instance, the offense is listed as homicide, not missing person. The date of the offense is 12/29/98, which is 2 weeks too soon, but the case number matches Hay's case, and the narrative provides, the undersigned is assisted the homicide team with searching the computer of a missing person. It is believed that the computer may contain information that will help locate the missing person. The missing person used America Online, AOL, to communicate on the internet. Therefore, the computer may contain email or other type of files that may lead to further information. The computer was tagged and brought back to the Computer Crimes Unit for forensics. Investigation to continue. And that report has a date of 2/8/99, February 8th, the day before Hay's body was found. However, the stamp on it, the one that says received by Central, says February 24th, 1999. So 4 days before Adnan's arrested, which means I think, or at least I hope, that we can safely conclude the report was in fact prepared after February 8th. It talks about assisting the homicide team, lists the offense of homicide, which means that whoever wrote it, hopefully, did so after February 9th. However, we know the latest it could have been written is February 24th, because on that date, someone in BCPD received the progress report, stamped it, and put it in the file. Now here's where it gets weird. You know those solvability factors I mentioned? The ones that are zero in all the previous reports? So solvability factors, what are they? The six different solvability factors involve A, the suspect, B, the vehicle, C, physical evidence, D, stolen property, E, whether there's any type of MO present, whether there's any type of modus operandi, and F, whether this investigation can be solved at the field level. The screening factors relate to solvability. That is, how likely is it this case will get solved or that there's a lead here that can result in a conclusion to the investigation? And again, that makes sense that everything's zero beforehand because at that point, they don't even know they have a crime. They certainly don't have suspects. They certainly don't have an idea where Hay's car might be. So yeah, everything's a zero. And then we get to this final report. Suddenly, things are no longer zeros.
Category A, suspect, has a 12. Category B, the vehicle, has a 12. Category D, stolen property, has a 4. And the other three are still at 0. Now, this scale goes from 0 to 12. 12 is the highest there is, which means if something's rated to 12, it's pretty much solved itself. Why then, on February 24th, did an officer with the Baltimore County Police Department think that solvability for this homicide and for finding one, a suspect, and two, Hayes' car, were the highest rating possible? Now, he was less certain with regard to the stolen property. The four suggests that they may have had a lead on it, but didn't really know where it was. But that still means that they had a lead on stolen property as well.
What I was thinking is, why is this on February 24th after her body's been found, even like it wasn't everything turned over to the city at that point after the 9th?
Well, that's why I think the report might have been dated February 8th, because that's the last day that it was still fully with Baltimore County. But as for why it was written after that and stamped after that, well,
I mean, this is what I remember when you showed this to me. What jumped out at me more than anything was that 12 for the vehicle, right? I mean, that a number of days before Jay is saying this is where the car is, somebody is saying that they know where the car is.
Well, February 24th is also the same day that the NCIC wrote back to Officer O'Shea with Baltimore County Police Department saying that they had the hits, they had the offline search request returned, and they had those two hits on Hayes' car. That's the only other event in Baltimore County on the 24th that I can think of.
So is it possible that if the detective followed up on the NCIC report, followed up on those hits, was able to track them down, and actually found the car?
It's possible, but the paperwork's such a mess, it's hard to say what's going on. I mean, of course, we cannot rule out the possibility that whoever wrote this report simply had no idea what they're doing. Wouldn't be the first time.
They had no idea what they were doing, but it's like when you're on a multiple choice test, right? You're just like, okay, I'm going to do everything A or everything C. But these are very deliberate choices. Like, two choices are 12. Three are 0. One is 4, right? They seem like they are deliberate choices and not just, I'm going to go down the middle of the road, or I'm going to make them all a 12, or I'm going to make them all a 0. You know, it seems too specific to be random to me. I don't know.
I'm not saying I disagree. It's just that's kind of the only options I see here. And I don't rule out the fact that this guy might have just been incompetent because, again, he did write the date of the offense as December 29th, 1998. So whoever wrote it wasn't completely paying attention to what was going on around them. It's a weird thing for an officer just to make up. What's also not in there, for instance, are Detective O'Shea's reports. We know from the Baltimore Police Department's file that O'Shea wrote a series of reports of his interviews, which were conducted from January 22nd to February 4th, and interviewed everyone from Don, Anon, Debbie, Aisha, Hope Shab, and his butler, Hayes' uncle, Hayes' stepfather out in California, Don's manager. So all of those reports were written. All those interviews were undertaken. And they're not in the file that Baltimore County handed over, which means they never had O'Shea's reports. Either they decided to toss O'Shea's reports and keep Adcock's, or O'Shea gave his reports directly to the Baltimore Police Department. So O'Shea either took no notes or only did a summary of his interviews long after the fact, and then never put them in the Baltimore County file, but handed them straight over to Ritz McGillivray. There are other documents, too, that we know were generated by Baltimore County and should have been in the Baltimore County file, but weren't there. For instance, we have O'Shea's notes from the Woodlawn interviews conducted during the homicide case. We know from the info sheets that he was there for some of them, but there's no sign of that in the Baltimore County file. We also know that the AUL subpoena, according to Baltimore Police Department's records, the Baltimore County Police did subpoena Hayes' email address. They had filed a subpoena with AOL and presumably got results for that. But that's also not in the file. And we know, for instance, that Baltimore County conducted an initial interview of neighbor Laura and neighbor Laura's father about neighbor boy and neighbor boy's story to Laura that he'd seen the body in a trunk. That was done in April of 99. And it was also written on the same progress report sheets that O'Shea's reports are written on. But again, that was not produced in this NPIA. It was not produced by the county. So the county's files are woefully incomplete. We know that most of their investigation, most of their documents aren't actually still with them because they didn't produce them. So yeah, the fact they didn't actually respond to my specific request for documents doesn't mean those documents weren't there at some point or aren't somewhere. It just means they're no longer in their files.
Hayes' car has always been one of the most important pieces of evidence in this case, and also one of the great mysteries of it for me. It's always seemed completely implausible to me that her car sat for 6 weeks in a neighborhood where every other car has a lock on its steering wheel. It's a high crime neighborhood with a very high police presence, and this car was never touched. Nothing was stripped, nothing was stolen, nothing was broken. It just sat there in the middle of four rows of townhomes, row homes really, where neighbors likely have lived for decades and know each other and know each other's cars and know who's coming and going. On top of which, it had sat through a number of storms that winter, but was in quite clean condition. So I have a lot of trouble buying the idea that that car was there for 6 weeks with nobody ever having reported it, without it ever having been touched, without it looking like it actually had weathered any of the storms. And there's also the question of whether or not Jay actually took the cops to the car himself, because, again, as we've discussed previously, at trial, he seemed to give testimony that might indicate that he had taken the police to the wrong location when they asked him to take them to the car. And also, once they began interviewing him, they took their time. They did not immediately say, okay, we got to go get this car and secure this evidence. These things are kind of odd to me. And now this Baltimore County Police Department document adds one more layer of uncertainty and lack of clarity to the whole mystery around the car. Why did previous reports have a factor of zero for the vehicle, and the very last one have a factor of 12, which is the highest ranking? If it was just somebody randomly filling out the boxes, it's kind of a weird way to do it randomly, right? I mean, I would think that if they're going to randomly fill it out, maybe they'll just fill them all out, threes or fours. But these were very specifically filled out. Only a couple of the boxes had factors that were not zeros anymore. And it's hard to figure out why. Now, the Baltimore County Police does not use the forms anymore. So officers right now that we have checked with are not familiar with this form. But we're hoping that someone out there is and maybe knows the weight that such a document might carry in terms of evidence about what the police really did know at the time. So the document is on the website. If there's anyone out there who knows law enforcement or who is part of law enforcement or formerly law enforcement, has used these kinds of documents before, we would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about what you think happened here and why on February 24th, when this document was created, the Baltimore County Police reported that they had a factor of 12 for Hayes' car. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/free. @Adnan.
This week's episode is also brought to you by EverAlbum. Have you ever run out of space on your phone? If you're anything like me and take way too many pictures of your cat, you probably have. But now you can have unlimited storage. Check out EverAlbum, a free mobile app that automatically protects your photos on your phone. You can easily sync your phone's camera roll, Facebook, Instagram, and Dropbox accounts so your pictures are always protected. Exclusively for Undisclosed listeners, EverAlbum is offering unlimited photo storage for free. Go to everalbum.com/undisclosed and download on iOS today.